This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 23rd of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. In today's show, our Hong Kong bureau chief meets designer Ilse Crawford to talk about the takeoff of the studio's latest project with Cathay Pacific.
It seemed logical to think about this space as a private space, to make it somewhere that addresses your real needs, but is somewhere where you feel free and grounded and good.
We also head to the UK's post-industrial heartland and stop at Sheffield Design Week.
There are all sorts of interesting things going on, and in terms of arts and designs, those things are very connected with industry as well in Sheffield.
All that to come and plenty more besides right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now to kick off the show, we head north from our base in London to a city known around the world for its cutlery. Last week saw the city of Sheffield here in the UK hosting its second annual Design Week, as a result of which many here are celebrating a renaissance of design, architecture and contemporary art in a city that's keen to marry its newfound creative identity with a lagging post-industrial economy. This year's theme was transformation, and a host of events around the city tried to pin down the transient concept. Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan headed to Sheffield to see a city showing that its design scene is about more than just knives and forks.
If I asked you to think of a contemporary design hub, Sheffield might not be the first place to spring to mind. But the city has a proud design heritage, rooted in its status as an industrial powerhouse in the 19th and 20th centuries. Sheffield Design Week looks to build on these foundations to stimulate and promote design in the city. I'm going to begin my day here in Sheffield by meeting up with the event's founder and director, Patrick Murphy, who is also the director of Made North, the design platform that Sheffield Design Week grew out of.
I think it's probably a good idea to explain what Made North is, and then that'll go on to explain or give foundation for Sheffield Design Week. We formed Made North about 3.5 years ago, with essentially the remit of trying to promote northern design, northern designers. It came from a background, I'm a graphic designer as a profession and moved into sort of design curation in the last sort of 10 years. But it was to sort of try to get and promote a background that exists in the north of really good design, and there's some really good design projects that happen. And it was to sort of try and create a platform that can promote that, really. And it was initially influenced by things like what the Scandinavian and Danish governments did in terms of promoting their own region in terms of a design product. So in the 50s, I think Danish and Scandinavian countries promoted their output as a nation to other nations in terms of their furniture and design skills, and then that started to take root, and obviously now Danish and Scandinavian furniture is really highly regarded.
Now it's time for me to meet an internationally renowned Sheffield designer in person. Patrick's kindly offered to drive me out to the HQ of David Meller Design, about 10 miles outside of the city in the Peak District National Park. David Meller was a Sheffield native and one of Britain's most famous designers. The company that bears his name is now run by his son, Corin, who's a designer in his own right. I'm hopefully going to talk to Corin about the company and about design in Sheffield more generally. To begin with, do you just want to tell me a little bit about your company, the history of your company, and the way in which that history is intertwined with the history of the city?
The company goes back quite a long way, certainly for as a design company. We go back to the sort of early roots of design, I suppose, and the Festival of Britain and Britain Can Make It. My father trained at the RCA in London and set up his first silversmithing workshop in Sheffield. He then got involved in designing all aspects of street furniture, including the traffic lights we all stop at every day, and then also took on many silver commissions. In the 70s, we actually started manufacturing, and I think that's really what we're mainly known for now, is actually manufacturing knives and forks. but there's much more to the company than just manufacturing. We're, I suppose, a design company through and through, in that we believe the best products are things that we've actually designed. They're also things that we've made, and very importantly to us, are also things that we actually sell. So we have our own shops. So I suppose the other bit of design that runs through the whole company is the architecture of our buildings. So it's sort of designed through and through, not just sort of superficial surface design.
Your foreman in the factory was telling me that all the staff are trained to do all the jobs. So there's continuity in the manufacture process, and people have a more holistic idea about the thing they're making. Where did you inherit this design philosophy from?
Well, I think it goes back to my father again. I think we sort of felt, purely from a sort of a making point of view, that we like the idea that people actually manufacturing the things that we've designed actually take pride in what they're doing. So the old sort of Sheffield philosophy that somebody worked on a press for 8 hours a day and they'd finish their shift was totally what we didn't want to do. So therefore, all the workforce rotate around, so they'll only spend a couple of hours actually doing one job. But also, probably more importantly, they can see the whole process really from, or they're involved in the whole manufacturing process from start to finish.
If Sheffield is going to grow and evolve as a design city, it'll need to invest in young talent. I'm back in Sheffield now, and on my way to Block Projects, a contemporary art space in a renovated cutlery and tuning fork workshop in the centre of town. I'm going to talk to some people involved in Design Week projects meant to engage local students and young designers.
I'm Renata Thierstruck, and I work at the School of Architecture, University of Sheffield. I'm running a studio there called Future Works with Julia Udall.
Hi, I'm Julia Udall, and I'm on the Stories of Change project, and I'm also part of the Architecture Department at the University of Sheffield.
Hi, my name's Charlotte Morgan, and I'm the Creative Director at Block Projects, which is a contemporary art gallery in the middle of Sheffield.
And that's where we are right now, in Block Projects. You've got an exhibition on called One Great Workshop, which is tying in with Sheffield Design Week. Do you want to tell me what that's about?
The title, One Great Workshop, comes from the very particular nature of Sheffield's industry, which was lots of small factories where people would collaborate across different factories and come together to make a single item. And we're basically today working with some students from the University Technical College to get them to think about the past, present and future of energy and industry in the city.
As an industrial design powerhouse, Sheffield was internationally significant. Do you see the city becoming internationally significant again in this new design era where we're moving away from heavy industry design?
I think it's already internationally significant. You know, a lot of the partners that we've been working with in the region are doing incredible things with industry. The AMRC, which is the Advanced Manufacturing Research Centre, is one of the catapult centres in the UK for industry. There are advances in robotics here at the university. There are all sorts of interesting things going on. And in terms of arts and designs, those things are very connected with industry as well in Sheffield.
Another interesting example is Gripple, actually, who are an employee-owned company, and they're really innovative and looking to massively expand, but they're really interested in the kind of research and development side of things. And certainly for the students that will be joining us today from the University Technical College, they're really keen to kind of work at these really kind of cutting-edge places.
My last appointment of the day is with Ian Anderson. Ian is the founder of seminal Sheffield graphic design studio, The Designers Republic, and is also Creative Director of Communications for Sheffield Design Week.
Could you tell me a little bit about the history of Designers Republic, specifically in relation to Sheffield and its history in the city?
We always refer to the Designers Republic being declared, and it was declared on Bastille Day 1986. And at the time, as in any city, there were a few smallish design agencies, marketing agencies, advertising agencies. But Sheffield doesn't have a real history of commerce, as does Manchester or Leeds. So the design industry is not the same as you would have in a bigger city where there's a lot of commercial enterprises needing or desiring design input. So when we started, really, we kind of started by accident. Because of my background in the music industry and through running magazines and promoting gigs, etc., in the city, basically, we were asked to design a record cover and then another one and then another one. And then there was a big article in Blueprint about us, and then there was one in NME about us. And all of a sudden, we were the flavour of the month, if you like. So late 80s, all through the 90s and early sort of 2000s, we were perceived to be really influential, both nationally and globally, which obviously puts on the map in Sheffield. But the point in Sheffield is that there's not so many places or things to design, or there weren't historically. And of course, that's changing now, and people are more open to it and seeing the benefit of good design and good communication. So I guess that in a lot of ways, we inadvertently trailblazed Sheffield as being a design hub. And now there's a lot of designers who would normally have had to go to Manchester or London or even abroad, you know, now stay in Sheffield because it's okay to do that.
Well, my time in Sheffield has come to an end, and I've certainly been impressed with what I've seen. Corin Meller, who I spoke to earlier, has said that Sheffield's past is in manufacturing, but its future is in design. If that's true, then Sheffield is certainly investing in its future. Other post-industrial cities looking to reinvigorate their creative industries might be well advised to take note. For Monocle 24, in Sheffield, I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan.
And now to Hong Kong, where last week the territory's airline Cathay Pacific opened its premier lounge for first and business class passengers. The pier, as it's called, was designed by Studio Ilsa, and our Hong Kong bureau chief Aisha Spears was there to meet designers Ilsa Crawford and Simon Large to discuss what the lounge reflects of Cathay Pacific's brand. They began by discussing the creative brief and how the London-based studio pitched its vision.
So we're sitting here at the Opera House just ahead of a talk that we're going to do today, because yesterday was a very exciting day for Hong Kong. The Pier First Class lounge opened, designed by Studio Ilsa. Ilsa, if you'd mind talking to us about how you came into designing this lounge. We've seen Haneda already. We know that Bangkok and Manila are open, and soon there'll be more. When did the process with Cathay start?
As far as the studio was concerned, was when we got an email asking us to pitch, and the mail basically said the timeline was quite short, and I got a phone call where I basically said, we'd love to pitch, but could we have a little bit longer? So we did, and came over to Hong Kong and got it.
And with the lounges that we've seen, Haneda was the first of this sort. Now we've seen the Pier First Class, we'll have the Pier Business Class, Bangkok and Manila, and then London and Taipei. What does this new lounge design reflect for the brand of Cathay?
Actually, originally, when we first found Ilsa, we'd just done some work on our design and some thinking around what Cathay Pacific design ethos should be, and we established four pillars that we thought were important: heartfelt warmth, considered simplicity, contemporary Asian, and joy of discovery. And these were some four well thought through pillars, and once we'd done that, we came across Ilsa, actually the fit was very natural, as I recall. Everything about the way that she designed the things that she designed fit those pillars. So we asked her to put forward a design for the pier, and then we saw that, and then we thought it was a logical extension to have all our lounges follow the same look and feel. It just encapsulated what we thought Cathay Pacific should look like on the ground. It was as simple as that.
When we were at the lounge yesterday, Ilsa, you said something very interesting, which is that it's not necessarily residential in feel, but it's private in feel. What do you mean by that?
I'm very interested by how today, in the technological age, we expect to feel at home in public space. So it seemed logical to think about this space as a private space, to give it the sort of attention you might a private space, so to give it a feeling of informality, to make it somewhere that addresses your real needs, but is somewhere where you feel free and grounded and good. Typically, I think the sorts of spaces that we tend to come across in airports are much more corporate and much more prescriptive, much more institutional.
And we're here to talk about well-being today. The well-being of someone in an airport is something which is quite tricky, I think. You're essentially there as a passenger to get from one place to another. So how do you, both at Cathay and also through your design with Studio Ilsa, kind of enable people to have at least a little break to feel well?
For me, well-being is a balance between what I call the cool head and the warm heart, because obviously there are many functional things that need to be addressed. But in the spaces where we feel really good, it's the unmeasurable things that matter. And so it was a process of, you know, intense research on the part of the studio. We spent a lot of time in lounges watching people. We read a lot of research. We talked to a lot of people about their priorities. when travelling. And that revealed certainly that today, for the frequent traveller, they really want to arrive feeling better than when they left. You know, I think they wanted a place that made them feel human, because the whole process, really, of going through airports is pretty stressful. And probably they're from a meeting in a boardroom to another meeting in a boardroom. You know, that moment is a moment when, funnily enough, actually, an airline can properly establish a relationship with its customers.
And Simon, tying that into Cathay's desire to enable their travellers to travel well, to live a life well-travelled, how does that extend from the lounges even beforehand to when you're booking a ticket and then in flight and when you land?
We put this sort of design ethos against all the touch points, if you like, that the passenger will have with us. And we're in the process now of kind of rolling them out. So it's important to think in the same way about a digital experience and how you go about researching your holiday or your next trip, and then how you then purchase, and then of course how you might get to the airport, and then the experience you have at the airport, and then in flight, and then the experience beyond, and the relationship you continue to have with consumers. So we try to think about the whole experience holistically, if you like, as much as we can, which is quite new for us, I think, new for many airlines. And of course, you know, particularly the digital area is a very new area for most airlines to be having to think about. But it's been very rewarding, and we're still going through kind of the rollout as I speak. But it has been very rewarding for us to think about design in that way, and why it might matter to people, and how it might make their lives easier if we do it well. And the feedback has been incredibly positive. Just small things make a huge difference to people's travel experience. And really thinking through the design of a lounge and getting the detail right can be the difference between, you know, a very mundane trip to a really, you know, excellent experience. That's really good to hear about.
That was Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau Chief Aisha Spears, of course, speaking to Ilse Crawford and Simon Large of Studio Ilse about The Pier, Cathay Pacific's first and business class lounge, which opened last week. Next, we ponder penmanship with one of the world's leading players in the industry. For over a century, German luxury brand Montblanc has manufactured and hand-assembled its high-end writing instruments from the best components. Think gold-nibbed fountain pens and mother-of-pearl logos. This month, the iconic firm unveiled its latest pen, and for the first time, the company looked beyond its in-house designers, hiring Australian Mark Newson to create its latest offering. Monocle's man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, sat down with Montblanc's CEO, Jérôme Lambert, to draw some conclusions about Montblanc's new fountain pen.
In a world moving increasingly towards the digital for communication, Hamburg-based Montblanc has held its ground, making elegant fountain pens like the brand's long-standing Meisterstück model to let people put down their thoughts on paper. So when it came time to update its portfolio of products, Montblanc CEO Jérôme Lambert decided to shake things up ever so slightly. He sought out prolific designer Mark Newson, who has created everything from planes to watches, to make a fountain pen that was both contemporary and yet in line with the German brand's traditional look.
In writing instrument, we create, launch a new line every 4-5 years, or not more. So it's like these plants that have a flower every 5 years. Normally they are magnificent, and you have to wait to see them. We have been working on that project with Mark since 2013 now. Chosen Mark because first, he's one of the most talented designers of his generation. By the way, generations that now design more and more the world in which we live. Second thing, Mark is one of the rare designers capable to extract and to work well the DNA of the maison while keeping his style. A posteriori, if I tell you that's a Mark Newson pen, you say, ah yes, I recognize that. If a priori I ask you how it will look like, no chance.
Holding the Montblanc M in the hand, one sees that Newson has moved away from the classic cigar-shaped lines of the fountain pen to something closer to his signature biomorphic style, with an organic shape that elegantly tapers at the end. The piece features a magnetic cap closure, and the device can be used for penning letters, as well as for technical drawings.
So here me using the Montblanc M. When it comes to the writing instrument, one element which is very clear is that this cut into the shape and this planar end part of the writing instrument with the integration of the snow cap. And here it is being a very challenging part of the project. The integration of the white snow cap and the black resin, seamless, without any variation of surface, requires a very high level of mastery of this precious resin.
Could you talk a bit about the materials used in making the pen?
So the resin, as every single part of this writing instrument, is work produced and realized in Hamburg, in our workshop in Germany. That's where Montblanc is creating his writing instrument since 1906. This precious resin arrived in Hamburg in its small granula, and then they are prepared, work, injected, work in high temperature. And then the magic of the transformation starts with all the unwork polishing of the writing instrument, which is required particularly for this particular shape. You know that one say, nothing is more black than a Meisterstück and a Montblanc M now. And indeed, you can put anything next to and you will see that's gray compared to that color. That very black, not because it's black at the start, it's because it absorbs all the light. It's the result of the polishing.
Now, in today's digital world with tablets and people using touchscreens, talk to me about the challenge of getting people to slow down and use something like a fountain pen.
I would say it's definitely about having the pleasure of writing. And I would say 20 years ago, analog was a requirement and digital was cool. Today, digital is a requirement, so analog can be cool. In the world of fine writing, today Montblanc is the only integrated maison doing everything from what to that, where you still see all the craftsmanship that is required to do a fountain pen or a pure writing instrument. You just imagine that any writing instrument of Montblanc is tested by any in our workshop. And when it comes to a fountain pen, every writing instrument is tested on at least 2 pages of paper, and they are tested just by the ears and the resistance that the person that is testing it will find on the paper or on the sound than your nip will do on the paper. You understand the magic and the poetry of this fine writing instrument.
That was our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, speaking to Montblanc CEO Jérôme Lambert. You're listening to Section D with me, Josh Fennett. To end the show, we return to the UK and hear from a designer who has been heralded by some as Britain's greatest. It is, of course, Thomas Heatherwick. From his work on the UK Pavilion at the Shanghai Expo in 2010, to the cauldron at London's 2012 Olympics and the city's reintroduced Routemaster bus, Heatherwick's work is unquestionably influential. But the designer has had his detractors too. As part of our big interview series running every week on Monocle 24, our very own editor Andrew Tuck caught up with Thomas Heatherwick.
I think you describe yourself as a designer, but when people look at your CV, they could easily think architect, sculptor, urban planner.
Well, I don't mean to be difficult, but it's only in contexts like this that I am supposed to say who I am and what I do in such sort of clinical terms. The thing I've been interested in ever since I was tiny was ideas. And it seemed that that's actually what we're all interested in. And as a child, you don't see a separation. No one is putting little file dividers between those realms. And so I was watching what was happening with cars back in the 1970s, and also looking at what was happening with buildings as Milton Keynes was being built, a new idealistic city being built from scratch, and looking at ice creams and wondering why weren't they bigger until years later they invented the Magnum. And it's like, well, of course, you, when you're little, you're there thinking, oh, how comes I can eat an ice cream and not feel sick? Now you can. So whether something was science or writing or art or sculpture or whatever, the things that seemed to mean anything to anyone were based on ideas. And so I was a bit surprised to find as I grew older that this world of conceiving of things or inventing, whatever you call it, was chopped up into all these areas. And it did seem that the chopping up was some kind of efficiency move, but simultaneously stopped the potential for interesting cross ideas, things that could slip interestingly between scales or different kinds of application or contexts. And so I found that you couldn't study inventing and the word mad was stuck at the beginning of that word. So I had to sort of find a way through, and the unpretentious word seemed to be a word design, but that was still associated and still is associated with the style rather than sometimes an idea. And I've been interested in, with my studio's work over the time since we set it up, in trying to find where you can apply ideas and make the most difference. And I suppose my passion was solving problems and making difference. And it sounds simplistic and a bit daft to say it that way, but that's been a sort of deep motivator.
You're doing all these projects around the world. Two of the most interesting are a new park in New York and a river bridge, hopefully, here in London, which will be a garden bridge, which has had some controversy around it. There's a bit of public debate going on around it. What's your interest in parks? Why do you think, you know, we've seen the popularity of the High Line in New York. Why do you think there's this fascination with new green space?
The garden bridge project that we're working on, I think it wasn't so much about green space is good, you know, the more the better. There was a city divided by a river that at its narrowest in the centre is 1/4 of a kilometre. And there are people who are more likely to go to New York than the other side of the city. And we've got a city that has turned its back on the river for many, many decades. And you have, particularly surprisingly on the north, everyone thought that there were problems on the south, but actually on the north, a dual carriageway means you can't get to the river edge. So there was this idea that an actor had, which was to try to not always see this river. It's 3 times as wide as the River Seine. So we take that for granted, that it's been this big obstacle. And so often the crossings have treated it as an obstacle to breach rather than a place to make. And if you actually go to Waterloo Bridge, which is this phenomenal, views from Waterloo Bridge are fantastic, but it's actually a dual carriageway designed for cars, buses, taxis, lorries and motorbikes. People are squeezed and marginalised to the edges of that. So this idea really was about putting people, making a place. If you're not so able-bodied, you think twice before you walk more than 1/4 of a kilometre. And so the garden made a place. And it was really the notion of making a garden that stitched together the city rather than a bridge and put some plants on it. And that was an individual idea that had a power. And I and my team have been very lucky to work with the Garden Bridge Trust. And I think that anything in a centre of a phenomenal city, or any city, is going to have some friction. And British people are some of the most hard-bitten. I mean, everything's going to be a disaster in Britain. And I think there was great astonishment when the Olympics wasn't the disaster everyone had predicted. In fact, it was a phenomenal success. And in a way, this has gained such momentum from following that. And one of the most moving things about the Olympics was all those wildflowers that were there. So this bridge really is a garden. It isn't a park. And it's something that doesn't exist that's free anywhere else in the world like this. So we were very captivated by it. And there are hundreds and thousands of people who are all helping us to make it happen. And sure, some people will be, there'll be some friction and some worry.
That was an excerpt of Andrew Tuck's big interview with the British designer Thomas Heatherwick. You can hear more of that interview and many more from the series by going to monocle.com, iTunes or SoundCloud. And sadly, that's all we have time for this episode of Section D with me, Josh Fennett. Today's show was produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact our producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com with any comments, queries or suggestions. Thanks for listening and goodbye.